Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Gnostic Media's Unspun episode. I think this is number 74, here with Jacob Duhlman. We have a great show lined up for this evening. Jacob's been digging deeper and deeper into the work, and now he's all the way back to Joseph Scaliger. And so that's kind of where things begin, and we're going to come forward on that. You know what? Before we dive into the show, I do want to thank Kane again for sending a donation from Kane's weekly allowance. Kane is 6 years old, so thanks so much, Kane, for supporting the show. I really appreciate that. Also, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Any donations you send, GnosticMedia.com, we really appreciate any support. Offer any support you can for Jacob Duhlman. I think he's offered up his email address each week as well. Jacob, welcome back to the show. So glad you're here. You and I have been discussing all week pretty much all of this lovely new material that we've been coming across. And, you know, we've been digging from different directions and unexpectedly finding more and more reinforcement, ironically, for Anatoly Fomenko. And so what I also wanted to say is I gave an interview the other day, and you joined me in the second hour with Kyle Hunt on Renegade Radio, and we broke down a lot of the research there. This is sort of the prerequisite ideas, sort of how we got to here, essentially, and now we're going to go into a lot more of the meat and potatoes and try to lay out a foundation of research for people to understand on who these people were that apparently faked history, how they're tying together into, you know, we found connections into the Bernays family, into the Dead Sea Scrolls, into, you know, the Gallants, you know, Israel Gallants, which goes down into the Fabian Society, as we've talked about with Jacob before. So now we're actually going to be going back a few centuries and then starting to bring the research forward. So, Jacob, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. This is it's been quite a wild ride. I mean, where could we even begin? I mean, last week, I began digging in an old dictionary called a dictionary, a general dictionary, a general biographical dictionary, historical and critical. And this was, I began collecting a few volumes of them over the years. They're pretty rare and hard to find, but it's one of the first biographical dictionaries ever created and printed in English. It was based off of Pierre Bayle, who is a French historian. He wrote this initially in French, and it was basically only about most notable French authors and people in history. And I think it was Pierre Mézou, picked it up and translated that from the French into English in the early 1700s. And then from there, Thomas Davidson, the publisher, picked it up, and with some fellows of the Royal Society, I'm kind of blanking off the top of my head, but I can pull up the title of the book here really quick with the names on them. They're fellows of the Royal Society, so this is worth it if you could just let me put the names quick. There's a lot of different books I have open up here, so it's going to be...
Yeah, well, you got to pull up your brain. Hopefully, we're going to have to get you a new computer that has enough power to run the video program for the show and your brain at the same time.
And then get a second monitor, too. Okay, so it's, the names are Reverend Mr. John Peter Bernard, Reverend Mr. Thomas Birch, and Mr. John Lockman. John Peter Bernard, I think, was mostly responsible with kind of editing and collating a lot of the older translations and making sure that they were correct. The Reverend Thomas Birch was responsible for adding a lot of the new English lives to the biography. So if there's
you're talking about this biographical dictionary.
About this biographical dictionary. I actually have the title right here. Wish I could share the screen. General dictionary. Actually, maybe I can share it for this. Let's try it. It's just the PDF. Is that coming on okay?
Yep, it's up.
It's a little bit blurry on there with some of the names because the Google scan didn't kind of come out too well. This is a general dictionary, historical and critical, in which a new and accurate translation of that of celebrated Mr. Bayle, with a correction and observations printed in the late edition at Paris, is included and interpreted with several thousand lives never before published. This whole containing the history of the most illustrious persons of all ages and nations, particularly those of Great Britain and Ireland, distinguished by their rank, actions, learning, and other accomplishments, with reflections on such passages of Mr. Bayle as seem to favor skepticism and the Manichee system. And this is by John Peter Bernard, Reverend Mr. Thomas Birch, and John Lockman. Okay, so now we're back over these names again. Now, Thomas Birch was the one I think
you
that was responsible.
Do you need that up still? Or you want to stop sharing screen now?
I can stop the share. All right, so Thomas Birch is responsible for adding all the new additions, a lot of the new additions and new articles into this dictionary. Scaliger was not present, which is kind of interesting because of the family's history in France. Was not included in Bayle's first dictionary, which was written in French. Then when Mézieux then did his translation into English, he did not include Scaliger as well. Now, these new men, Thomas Birch, he's the first person to write this biography of Scaliger and put it into the book. And this was published in, I think, volume one was in 1734 off the top of my head. This was published in series of volumes 1 through 10 from 1734 until 1741. So this dictionary is also kind of interesting because it was also written around the same time when Samuel Johnson was alive. And
who's he?
Samuel Johnson wrote Samuel Johnson's Dictionary, which is probably one of the most famous dictionaries written about the English language. His citations are somewhat hilarious at times. I definitely recommend looking up Samuel Johnson's definition of fart, because he has
and
an interest.
What were you doing digging straight in to look up the definition of fart?
Well, I was an English major in college. Okay. And so one of the professors, you know, one of their jokes was, you know, we were going to talk about Samuel Johnson. Let's talk about his fart citations, which are actually interesting. It's some good poetry that they're pulled from. So if you want some good fart poetry, go to Samuel Johnson's dictionary. But anyway, he had a lot of conversations with the authors of this book that I'm discussing now, the biography.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're starting off with fart jokes.
Yes. Fart. Yeah, well, man, I could take this in a different direction with that too, but I'm not going to say the naughty word. Well, we're starting to talk about the people we're going to talk about today.
That's all right. Go ahead.
So it's kind of a family show at times, right? Okay, so
6-year-olds in the audience.
Yes. So Scaliger, the family, their articles are in this dictionary.
You know what? Let's back up before we go into this, because I want to just give a little bit of a preamble on Scaliger, so the people know who he is, who may have missed the previous shows with you and my talk yesterday on flamenco. So I'm going to pull up my brain database here and just show him on screen so that people know who he is. This is Joseph Justus Scaliger, University of Paris, and he's really apparently who gave us, you know, what is modern chronology or Scaligerian chronology, modern history as it's organized and laid out today. And he worked with a guy by the name of Denis Petau or Dionysius Petavius, who was his student, this guy here. And so these, Denis Petau, he was a Jesuit, University of Paris. But these guys created the modern history that we see today that is essentially the official historical record. And basically, before these guys, there wasn't much of an historical record as we see linear time in history today, like such and such happened in ancient Rome at a certain time, such and such happened at, you know, some other time in ancient history. So he's the one who laid it all out. And then ironically, Jacob Bernays, who is the father or the grandfather of Edward Bernays, wrote Scaliger's biography, etc. You know, and then of course Edward Bernays becomes the father of propaganda. But that's just, you know, a quick rundown on this guy who we're going to be discussing tonight, so that people can understand how he was essentially committing fraudulent and fallacious historical research. And so, using contemporary and near contemporary sources. We're going to basically be showing what scholars of his time even thought about Scaliger. So yeah. Back to you, Jacob.
So you just mentioned Jacob Bernays' biography of Joseph Scaliger. That was printed in Berlin in 1855. So that's over 100 years after the biography that I'm going to be reading from tonight. So just put a little perspective on where we're coming from here, is that some of the source material either comes from this book or it doesn't. I don't know. I haven't read the German biography yet, but it's just interesting. We're going to be reading from stuff that may have been omitted in the future.
In the future or in the past?
Well, biographically in the future for Scaliger and his history.
Got it.
Yeah. All right. So where shall we begin? Let's start with his father, Julius Caesar Scaliger. Now, Scaliger, well, I might as well just reading it.
Well, okay. And do you want to just remember you can share your brain database or whatever whenever you need to?
Yeah, I think we had some video problems with that one, though. Let me see if I can pull it up here. I have Julius called up on the window here. Oh, shoot. I just started Skype. Now this is going to cause a problem.
All right. Well, just cancel here we go. That.
We're gone. We're fine. All right. So here it is. Is that coming through okay?
Yes, it is.
All right, great. It's working tonight. All right, so that's Julius Caesar Scaliger Bodone. You can notice that there's the last name there that doesn't fit, and his Scaliger's in quotes. We're going to get into that now. So reading from this dictionary, Volume 9, you will not find this book online. The scans only go from Volumes 1 through 8 and Volume 10. Volume 9, I spent weeks trying to find this, and I can't find it. I mean, even before I knew that Scaliger was in this and I wanted to just collecting this dictionary, I couldn't find this book. But then luckily on eBay, I was able to find an edition here in Tennessee. The seller wasn't aware of how priceless this book probably is. And the book was destroyed. So I was able to get it at a nice price considering.
Basically, it was a bunch of loose pages, et cetera, right?
The binding is pretty much coming apart. There's no spine to it. The cover's detached. Both covers are detached. Most of the sewing inside is also coming apart. But it's kind of interesting to look at it from a historical perspective if you like books, because you can see how a book in the 1700s was bound by kind of looking at the size and seeing how the string was attached and sewn through. Interesting, but not necessarily where we want to go tonight with our discussion. So this book, I started paging through it. And what's interesting is there's a little finger pointing like this next to the name, and that's how you know it's a new edition to the dictionary. And it starts off with this: Scaliger, and then in parentheses, Julius Caesar, is said to have been descended from the ancient princes of Verona. And then this goes to a footnote here. And this book is very famous for its footnotes. Most of the content is footnote. There's barely much of a biography because everything goes into the footnotes and details everything there. So Julius Caesar Scaliger is said to have been descended from the ancient princes of Verona and was the son of Benedict Scaliger, who commanded for 17 years the troops of Matthias Corvinus, king of Hungary, to whom he was related, and Bernice Lajonia, daughter of Count Paris Magnus. He was born at Ripa, a castle in the territory of Verona, April the 23rd, 1484. He learned the first rudiments of the Latin tongue in his own country, having for his preceptor John Jocundus of Verona. And when he was arrived at his 12th year, he presented to the Emperor Maximilian, who made him one of his pages. He served that emperor 17 years and gave signal proofs of his valor and conduct in diverse expeditions in which he attended his master. He was present at the Battle of Ravenna in April 1512, in which he had the misfortune to lose his father and brother Titus. He conveyed their bodies to Ferrara, where his mother resided, who died some time after with grief. His father dying in narrow circumstances, he was soon reduced to great necessity, which made him resolve upon entering into the Franciscan order, upon which account he went to Bologna, where he applied himself vigorously to study, especially to logic and Scotus's divinity. But soon changing his mind with regard to becoming a monk, he took arms again and served some time in Piedmont, where he distinguished himself by his extraordinary valor. Now this is now kind of perceived as a little bit.
Do you want to stop sharing or?
Oh, I'm still sharing. I'm sorry. I was looking off.
I interrupted you there while you were reading. So go ahead.
You weren't missing much. I was looking like this on my iPad. Yeah. So
there's the little tiny window for those who were wondering.
that's a good break because now we can go back to that first footnote under A. Now we have kind of the official, according to Julius and his family, kind of biography of how he started and where he comes from, his roots. We can now kind of break down into the footnotes on what the editors.
Well, just to interject and interrupt you for a second, I find it amusing, interesting, worthy of notice that, you know, Joseph Scaliger is Julius Caesar, and then his father is, what did you say, Titus, or, you know?
No, Julius Caesar is the father, is Joseph Scaliger's father's name.
Yeah, excuse me.
And then his brother, I think it was his brother's name was Titus. It's kind of weird, because the way it was worded, it could have been his brother, could have been his father. It's weird.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting, but, you know, when we see these, and you're going to go into it in a moment, but there is this quote that's totally exposing Joseph Scaliger and his reporting of his own family's history is entirely fraudulent.
Yeah, that's where I'm going right now.
Right. You know, so, but what I'm saying is here's the guy who fakes all of this history. And then is it irony? Is it coincidence theory that, you know, the historical figures that we often investigate are named after his own family is, you know,
that's kind of weird. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree in this family.
Well, let's get into that quote.
Yeah, let's just dive into it because there's a lot to go through here. So under footnote A, I'll go back and read that sentence again so you guys have it fresh in your head. Scaliger Julius Caesar is said to have been descended from the ancient princes of Verona. Footnote A. Now we shall proceed to the footnote. Joseph Scaliger. His son asserts this in his epistle in Ionum Dausum de Vestuste Gentis Scaligari. A lot of the stuff's in Latin. I'm going to butcher it. So apologies in advance. Joseph Scaliger, his son asserts this, but this assertion seems to be contradicted by the letters of naturalization granted by Francis I, King of France, to Julius Caesar Scaliger, in which the mention of such a descent would not have been omitted if it had been well founded. Whereas he is styled there under Doctor of Physic. He takes there the name of Julius Caesar de l'Escale de Bodome, which last word Mr. de la Monnoye supposes ought to be read Ordonis. The omission of a point over the I before the last letter occasioning it to be read Bordomes. He calls himself there also a native of Verona, because he was born in the territories of that city, and because that city was better known in France than the castle of Ripa. Some authors have attacked the nobility of Scaliger's family and pretend that he was son of a schoolmaster of Verona named Benedict Burden, who, going to settle at Verona, took the name of Scaliger because he had a ladder for his arms or because he lived in Ladder Street. Thuanus observes that Augustin Niphus was the first inventor of this story, and tells us in his life that when he passed through Padua, Niphus endeavored to persuade him of the truth of that fiction, which he had invented out of resentment against Julius Caesar Scaliger, who in his writings had not shown regard enough for the works of Niphus, his grandfather, and in this common conversation preferred Pomponatius before him. But Joseph Scaliger assures us that Melchior Guiadin and Anthony Riccoboni were the first who pretended to attack his family and supplied Robert Titius with the stories related by him upon that subject. So now you can kind of see the damage control that Joseph has to do for his father and a lot of the other people who are kind of his friends, kind of saying, well, that's kind of bullshit. He was just doing that because he was attacking my grandfather, blah, 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 blah. You know, this is just the first example of this. Now, what's interesting is if I proceed further into his son's biography, Joseph Scaliger, let me just find the page here. It has an interesting quote. Actually, you know what? I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong thing. I need to go to Paulus Aemilius. Now, Paulus Aemilius is where Julius Scaliger asserts his name and his birthright. Let me just pull up my brain database. That's where the quote is located. Okay. Okay. Okay, so I'm just going to start. It's just a sentence from Paulus Amelius' biography that'll lead us into the footnote that talks about our subject. It says, Some notice must be taken of a work which Julius Scaliger ascribes to him, and the bustle that Scioppius made on that account. My computer's just running a little slow. I'm zooming in so I can read the footnotes. They're very tiny. I mean, this is, you have to work for it. Okay. So Julius Scaliger boasted his having seen a book containing the history of the family Della Scala, and which was translated into beautiful Latin by Paulus Amelius. Now I'm going to skip the Latin and just go to the English translation just to save your ears. Those titles of count and marquise that are now so common were not then known, nor did the authority of the Scaligers then flourish. Would you have me assert our annals, which being rude and barbarous, as was the complexion of those times, were drawn up in the most beautiful Latin by Paulus Amelius, that worthy man and eloquent writer? Joseph Scaliger relates this more at large in a letter written by him in 1504 on the antiquity of his family. By the wild havoc of time, the malice of enemies, and the ignorance of writers, a great number of memoirs relating to our family were lost, so that the name of Scaliger would probably have been extinct had it not been for Paulus Amelius of Verona, that most eloquent writer and preserver of antiquities, who, having found in Bavaria very ancient annals of our family, written, as he himself tells us, in a coarse style, he polished and translated them into Latin. From this book, my father extracted such particulars as seemed to reflect the greatest honor on our family. He had not leisure to go through with the rest, which I wish, however, he could have done, and had left me the labor of publishing it. He also speaks of it in the first edition of his commentary on Catullus in 1576, and in the second anno 1600. But in such a manner as, with regard to certain circumstances, does not agree with what I have cited on his letter, de vetustate and splendor gentis Scaligeri, i.e., of the antiquity and splendor of the Scaliger family. Scioppius is an intimate friend of Joseph Scaliger. His real name, not his Latin name, is Gaspar Schulp. So Scioppius insulted him.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because apparently they were also, you know, creating Latin pen names, nom de plumes, for themselves.
Oh, yeah. Not only that, but Joseph Scaliger has a few of them. I have one listed on my brain database. There's another one that I'll read as we go through some of his footnotes. It seems like that, and it's always like when he gets attacked or he gets criticized, he'll then create a pen name, and then he'll go and he'll attack his attacker with that pen name, rather than coming and approaching him head on with his own name, which is what an honest man would do if he was attacked. But instead, he creates a different name and then goes on.
So it's like these online trolls who can't handle a straight argument, and then they'll create a fake avatar and then go and attack you under that on Facebook or something.
Yeah,
realized my volume was way low, so I apologize. I meant to check that earlier.
So these are like the first trolls that you're finding. I mean, why, if you're an honest man and you stand behind your work, why do you have to go and defend yourself by creating a different name and attacking the person, rather than standing up for your own work and backing it up? I mean, that's not something a scholar does. That's something that a troll does. And, you know, this is kind of what we're
going to... So it's like Joseph Scaliger almost invented online, or, you know, trolls.
In a sense, I mean, if you look at the education of them. Now, Joseph Scaliger, which is interesting because we're seeing him defend his father. Now, when he was about age 13, he was sent off to boarding school with his brothers. But about at age 13, the plague had gone through the area where they were living. So the family took them back. Now, at this point, Joseph Scaliger was taken under his father's wing, and he was taught by Julius Caesar Scaliger, pretty much only. I mean, he had to write Latin verses. Actually, you know, there's, now that we're kind of going here, I have a different biography from a cardinal I could pull up. They'll talk
somebody is just stating that they have no idea what we're talking about. I tried to give a little recap at the beginning. Can you just try to encapsulate for the audience where we're going very quickly?
If you just kind of walked into the show and you missed the beginning, what we're talking about is Scaligerian chronology. Now, Joseph Scaliger is the person who kind of laid the foundations for chronology.
And chronology is where we get, you know, the modern layout of history that we all assume, you know, ancient Rome was 2,000 years ago, or, you know, up to, you know, 900 BC, something like that, and Israel and all of this stuff, and the layout of Europe and what happened and when, all of the official historical record, all of the linear, quote-unquote, history that we've been fed through high school, university, etc., was created and laid out by this guy Joseph Scaliger and Dennis Batavius, and what we're showing as is that these guys were frauds and faking this stuff. So Jacob has been digging up the contemporary and near contemporary quotes of other scholars discussing these guys and how bad and fraudulent their work was.
Yes, that's pretty much, I think that's a good way of stating it. So we're going through this biography. I'm looking up Joseph Scaliger, trying to find this quote from a cardinal that basically called him dull as a child and was not very exemplary, but I can't seem to find it at the moment. So like what we're trying to do is we're going through Joseph Scaliger's biography. We don't have much information on him before 1855, and in 1855, Jacob Bernays, the grandfather of Edward Bernays, wrote his biography. So we're kind of seeing
Let's explain who Edward Bernays is for the audience who doesn't know. Edward Bernays is the father of propaganda and spin. He worked with Gordon Wasson, who helped kick off the psychedelic revolution, etc. But most of the propaganda tactics and spin tactics that we know of out there today are from guys like Edward Bernays.
Yes. So we're kind of seeing here now that we were just talking about trolls and creating pen names and pseudonyms. And now we're kind of seeing Edward Bernays and propaganda and kind of influence people's minds. You know,
what we're seeing is the actual linear history of the trolls and the propagandists and how they operate, going all the way back to Joseph Scaliger and Dennis Batavius.
Yes. So like what we're kind of trying to do is create a chronology of trolls.
Yes, exactly. A chronology of propaganda, essentially. So, but a real chronology that people can now go out and fact check. Whereas, you know, since these clowns, nobody's been able to do.
Yes. So Joseph Eustace Scaliger was born an agent in 1544. And made his school studies at Bordeaux, where he was only remarkable for his exceeding dullness, having spent 3 years in a fruitless, though painfully laborious attempt to master his first rudiments of the Latin language. And it says, these clouds of morning, however, were but the prelude of a brilliant day. And this is from the life of Cardinal Mezzofanti. And that was from 1858, which is just a little bit after Jacob Bernays' biography of Joseph Scaliger. So, where were we before this? So we were just talking about Scioppius.
Exactly.
We're talking about Scioppius and his friend. So let me pull it back up, that PDF. And we were talking about how Scaliger created a pen name.
You gonna share screen, or what are you doing there?
I'm just reading straight off the page, and unless I want to kind of read with me, but it's dull and blurry and not really easy to read.
Why don't you share it just so they can, that way the doubting Thomases can see exactly what we're looking at.
Okie dokie. I have a slow computer, so like it scrolls really slow.
Ladies and gentlemen, donate to Jacob so that he's been spending all of his money on these books to help us understand this stuff, so he could really use a new laptop donation.
Yeah, that would be fantastic, but
we did actually get one guest a new laptop once so that she could come on the show.
Was that Kathy Morgan?
It was Kathy Morgan, indeed.
Yes.
And we should have her back on again sometime soon, too.
Yeah, we've been meaning to talk to her.
Hi, Kathy, if you're listening. She usually listens. She's usually in the chat room.
Hi, Kathy. Don't worry, I'll get your email reply to you. I've been very busy.
Yeah. Okay, let's just stay focused.
Okay, so I can't find my place now.
All right, you were looking for the quote there in the stuff. You still haven't shared screen, by the way.
Yeah, I just want to find where I am before I share screen because it's just there's too much.
So you
on.
Can bumble privately rather than in public, but it's still yes. To us it's the same waiting here. So,
God, this is so weird. I can't find my spot.
The answer to 1984 is 1776. Bad joke for the ones who get it. Sorry, I don't get it, Lee. Well, let's just continue on. If you can't find it, let's. Okay, you got it.
I'll just pull up the screen just so you can see it. Okay. All right. So I believe we left off. Let's see. He also speaks of it in the first edition of his commentary on Catullus. I think that's kind of where we stopped. But in such manner as this, with regard to certain circumstances, does not agree with what is cited. Okay. So of the antiquity of and splendor of the Scaliger family, Scioppus insulted him in the most cruel terms upon account of these little variations, and asserted further that whatever the two Scaligers advanced relating to this work of Paulus Aemilius was all imposture. Among other reasons, he employed these that no mention was made either of the place or pretended that the manuscript was found, nor the name of the person who possessed it, and that such authors as had searched with the greatest care the Bavarian libraries had never met with those annals.
Yeah, that's a pretty damning quote there against, Scaliger.
And it continues on here. So now there's some more Latin that goes on, and it says, I believe, let me just get the make sure I got the author correct, because there's a conversation that's going on between these two men. So let's see. I don't think they said the author here, which is kind of unnerving. Oh, geez. See, this is why.
Your computer's getting overloaded there. That's the problem.
Yes. Okay. So this is from Joseph Scaliger. I can see the citation down on the bottom at number 43. Okay. So being a little curious, I have thought proper to make some inquiries about Paulus Aemilius. First, is it likely that Aemilius was ever in Bavaria and understood the oldest German language? Now you got to put your fallacy caps on here because he's trying to discredit Scioppus.
And this is on the right side of the page, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, it's right here.
There you go.
And in what corner of Bavaria did he find those annals of the Scaliger family when they had escaped the utmost diligence of Aventius, Hundius, Lysias, and even of the Bavarian Scaligers themselves? Was it possible that the illustrious Marcus Valserius, governor of the city of Augsburg, that singular ornament of the age, could not have discovered those annals in some place or other? Has any man once heard the least thing you say that there were four books of Catullus, of that of Aemilius? To this, Joseph Scaliger replied that a great many books were still unknown, so that no one ought to conclude that Paulus Aemilius had never existed because it was not to be found. Okay. I hope you guys kind of understand that. So I was reading a quote from Scioppus.
Okay, let's minimize the, let's get rid of the share screen now.
So it's reading a quote by Scioppus, who's saying that he can't find this stuff anywhere in Bavaria that he's talking about, to which Scaliger replies, well, just because you can't find it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
And he's the only person who has any record of it ever existing, and no other scholar ever found it ever in history before Scaliger.
Yeah, so he's trying to find this document, and he can't. And he's claiming that, it's so bizarre that Scaliger could just get away with these things. It's like, well, you can't find it, doesn't mean it doesn't exist, therefore you're wrong.
Right. Well, and when it's the onus of proof obviously falls on Scaliger to prove the authenticity of this document rather than saying, oh, you don't believe me, you're wrong. That's just, you don't believe in the little green fairy on my shoulder. You're not spiritual enough.
And if you look at if you kind of go on their biographies, even like on Wikipedia, you can kind of see just like, well, their basic education. And generally it's, logic and rhetoric is one of the top things that are put on there. Never grammar, but logic and rhetoric. So you can kind of see that this is kind of like sophists at play, where they're just trying to prove themselves right. They're not trying to show and prove the truth. They're just, trying to win arguments. And what we're seeing here is just a battle of arguments, not truths.
Yeah, exactly. Well put.
And these are the guys who are responsible for, transcribing.
It's like, it's a sophist battle of bullshit. And Scaliger's trying to prove that his bullshit is the best bullshit and everybody should believe it and, you know, step in it.
Yes, pretty much. And we can continue on because there's more to this story as we go further. Would you like me to share a screen as I read along?
Sure.
Okay, so sharing screen. Okay, so we left off.
There you go.
Basically right here at the end of the quote. So we'll start back up where Joseph Scaliger replies to Cyopius. To this, Joseph Scaliger replied that a great many books were still unknown, so that no one ought to conclude that Paulus Aemilius had never existed. Paulus Aemilius said it never existed because it was not to be found. He proved Cyopius guilty of an untruth, for Julius Scaliger had not declared that Paulus Aemilius had translated this work from the German language. Now, there's some Latin here, but it gets translated below. I'm just going to scroll down really quick. I ask whence do they infer that Julius said that those annals were written in the Bavarian tongue? But it may not be improper to consult the verses of Julius. We find them in the little book of the Subversion of Kingdoms. Interesting title. For Paulus Aemilius says that both are mentioned, extracted from the book, which, he relates, was by him polished, justly from the Latin, written Bavaria. These had been omitted by Torellia Serenia. Now, it is plain to a child that Julius called that book of annals Bavarian because it was wrote in Bavaria and found in that country by Aemilius, not that it was writ in the Bavarian tongue. What better interpreter can we give of Scaliger's words than Julius Scaliger himself? Thereupon, Joseph Scaliger quotes his father's words, which we introduced at the beginning of this remark. Cyopius did not deny, but he was mistaken in this, but asserted that this was not a considerable article in their dispute. And I will read, I have to zoom in a little bit closer here because there's a smaller footnote to the side of the footnote. Part of my computer as it slowly crawls to it. And I have to move my screen over. All right, so this is Cyopius now going back and returning to what Scaliger just said about how the book wasn't written in Bavarian, it was written in Bavaria, therefore you're wrong. Cyopius wrong about the Scaliger family not being Scaligers. I grant you that your father's words, by which he says that Aemilius translated into Latin the Bavarian annals, were so rightly understood by Cyopius, which however may still admit of dispute. But I deny that Cyopius introduced them as though they were the subject he designed to contend about. So what's interesting is the guy is saying, like, yeah, he might have been wrong about that, but that wasn't his argument. He was talking about something else entirely. So why are you trying to shred him to pieces about something that wasn't even the argument? Why don't you approach his argument, Mr. Guy who has to write in pseudonyms instead of approaching the person who's...
Yeah, are you going to be continuing with this quote, or do you want to unshare screen? Okay.
It'll end right here. So I just finished with 47 and pretended that he was not able to answer his other questions. I shall conclude with the following remark. Paulus Aemilius was one of the heroes of Julius Scaliger, who complimented him with a little poem conjointly with Torellia Serena, who inferred this poem in a work called Heroes. So Julius Scaliger wrote a poem about Paulus Aemilius, calling him a hero. I can't find the poem. I'm still trying to find that. It might not even exist anymore. Who knows? Or if it does, it might be a priceless book that I will never be able to afford.
And Bill Gates is bomb-proof book archives.
or it's buried down in the Vatican. You never know. Right. So what's interesting about this is he's trying to immortalize this person who wrote this tract that Cyopius can't find to check the work. So he's just trying to cement this person's name in history a little bit further by kind of talking about him and his annals. So it's almost like he's just kind of adding a little more glitter to his name.
Right, and manufacturing, again, a history that didn't previously exist and then tossing it back. But he's not doing it in the sense that he and Denis Batavius did, doing it at 333 1053 and then 1800 years. He's just tossing it back, you know, a generation or two into his own family and trying to fluff up his own past with BS.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that's the way it kind of looks like it. And there's some interesting citations if you go under Julius Scaliger and Joseph Scaliger, where they kind of talk about how they don't really quite
want to get rid of the share screen or no?
Yeah. We're done with this page. Paulus Aemilius is now concluded. we'll probably go up to Joseph Scaliger next. But what's interesting about Julius is, like, he would omit and take poetic license when he would translate manuscripts from the Latin. I think Horace might have even been one of them. He translated Aristotle's love poems, and he brought those manuscripts out. So it's kind of interesting that Julius Scaliger is associated with those. I think now they're not even attributed to Aristotle, if I remember correctly, off of my studies. I just briefly only spent a few minutes on that topic. If I remember correctly, Aristotle's love poems were falsely attributed to him, and Julius Scaliger was associated with that a long time ago.
Yeah, and if you look at just deleting, as Famenko suggests to do, this thousand-year dark age, you have a wholly different picture of chronology and history, you know, and you collapse 1,000 years out of that, and, you know, the timing of Aristotle and Plato and all of these people is then totally different, you know, and then we have Scaliger and these guys messing with the official history and the translations and people's names and everything else.
Not only that, but they also take these Latin names, and it's like that's like the Latin revival. I mean, we're talking about the Renaissance at this point. And then you look at, like, even like the architecture, the classical, you know, Roman architecture is starting to kind of come up at the same time. And, like, if you don't, probably thinking the same thing here.
Well, no, what I'm thinking is that, in a sense, you know, they're MK Ultraing other scholars with this crap. You know, they're doing it to their own people, essentially, at their own.
Their
contemporaries at their own academic level, et cetera. Those who would read their stuff, which obviously wasn't the common folk.
Yeah, like if you look at, I remember in chapter one, I think it was chapter one, Famenko was talking about Aristotle and Plato not being actually that, you know, it was like Platon. And what was Aristotle? I think had a G name, though. I can't remember.
I can't remember either. But yeah, he talks about that. And he suggests, that Plato was really this guy,
yes.
Platon, this scribe or scholar or whatever he was, in what, the 14th or 15th century, I forget.
Yeah, it's right around this time. Probably, I think that these would have been like the teachers of Julius Scaliger, because he was born in like the late 1400s, and these are the people he kind of looked up to. And as someone who is accused, I don't think we can verify it, but he's been accused. You can even see the citation on Wikipedia of being a student of the University of Padua. Now, Padua is interesting because we tie that back to a lot of the agents, especially Sir Francis Walsingham, who was Queen Elizabeth I's spy master, who was responsible for creating a spy network all over Europe. I mean, that was his job.
And who was his first spy? Wasn't it Dr. John Dee?
Yeah, John Dee.
That Terence McKenna and all these people worship, you know, that he was the first spy for the Queen of Elizabeth, you know, and, you know, McKenna even has a whole video dressing up like him and doing this whole song and dance, you know, but they're not telling you that this is all a spy network. Why would modern spies like McKenna be doing a show and tell about historical spies unless they're all this just stretch spies?
And these bloodlines, they have such a vested interest. I mean, if you kind of, just looking at the histories, you know, you only kind of glance at them, like the kings and queens, they kind of come in, you're just like, I'm going to decree this, I'm going to, you know, make this a law. And then it kind of trickles down from there. But they all seem to have this vested interest in, like, preserving their lines. But they also are at war with each other at the same time. And it's intellectually, as well as, you know, physically. I mean, and the intellectual war I'm kind of seeing right now. And if you look at, you know, France and England, they have that history that going between them. This is Pierre Bayle's dictionary. Now the English have to go and make their own impression on top of that and add their authors as well and their own take on it and add to it. And now if you also look in the 1800s, you know, one of the most famous encyclopedic dictionaries to ever exist was published in Germany. So they have these three competing cultures with all these different dictionaries kind of coming at each other. So there's so much to study.
Well, and let me hold you right there, because look at what's happening right now. You have the Ecole Biblique of the Vatican. You have the Anglican Church and, you know, the Royal Society of England. And then here you have the Russian Society putting all of this information out, saying, wait a second, look, all of this stuff is fake, you know. So it, again, it looks like the same intellectual battle going on modernly that was happening in the 16th century there.
You know, it's interesting because, like, we're talking about, well, like, 19th century has been kind of a focus of my research, and this is a good point to kind of segue to it off of Joseph Scaliger, and maybe we can kind of come back to him and at the end of the show and pull out some other nuggets and juicy quotes. I know there's one you probably want to hear that I read to you before the show started. But let me just
absolutely, we definitely want to get that in, even if we got to go over time. So,
okay, so let me just find the actual citation, because he did some work on the New Testament, and I have to pull it up off of my iPad here. Was it XII? I apologize for the gap. I know with programs and stuff like that, this it's generally not kosher to do that. All right, so I found the book. So this is there's a chronology of Joseph Scaliger's works in the footnotes of this biographical dictionary, and his 22nd release, Novum Testamentum Graecae cum Josephi Scaligeri in locos difficulere notis. This was printed in Geneva in 1619 in 4TO. Now this must be after his death, because I think he died in 1603 or 4. Cum notis Roberti Stefani Isigaki Casuaboni and Alerion. This is printed in Leiden and Elsevier in 1641 in 8vo. All right, so there's a bunch of different names here, but we'll just get down to the quote. So in Critique Sacrée, Monsieur Simon in his Histoire Critique observes that the notes upon the New Testament published under Scaliger's name are so few and so inconsiderable that they did not deserve a place among the critical commentators. There are a few of them worthy of that learned man who had not applied himself to that study. So this must be an edited edition of the New Testament with Scaliger's notes added to it. But the people who read it and reviewed it, you know, called it just a bunch of bull because he never really ever studied the New Testament. So it's just kind of interesting that his name is associated with something that's probably tied to biblical archaeology and the history of the Bible and trying to relate it to geographical locations.
That's probably a whole other path you could go off onto, or, you know, maybe some nice soul out in the audience will want to track down all of those citations, and, you know, we can find out what happened there eventually, you know.
Well, what's interesting about the New Testament, you know, and this biblical archaeology, if we kind of want to go back up to my research in the 19th century, is that I was reading chapter one, and I was going back over some notes that I had in there in Anatoly Fomenko's book. Let me just pull up my brain, because I have the passage actually written down inside of there. Under Jericho, I believe. Yep, it was under Jericho. So this is I'm gonna read a few paragraphs from History, Fiction, or Science from Anatoly Fomenko, page 39-40. The Bible lists a great many geographical locations that the people of Israel visited during the 40 years of wandering after the Exodus from Egypt. The archaeologists still fail to find these locations where the Scaligerian history places their biblical descriptions. Wright says that few sites on the way to Mount Sinai can be identified with any degree of certainty. V. Stade wrote that, quote, checking the itinerary of Israel has as much sense as, say, tracking the way of the Burgundians, returned from King Etzel, as described in the Nibelungen. The Egyptologist W. Spielberg quotes this statement, saying that we can still sign under every word of Stade's, and the depiction of events follows the Exodus. The listing of the sites where stops were made, the crossing the desert, all of this is fiction. Many sites that were considered to have been on the itinerary of the Israelis were excavated thoroughly and intensively for a long time now. No traces have ever been found. Now, this next paragraph I'm going to read is where it connects to my research. The biblical account of the destruction of Jericho is well known. One of the Arabic settlements in the Middle East had been arbitrarily identified as the Biblical Jericho, whose walls were destroyed by the sounds of the horn. The horn is interesting too, because you just laugh because I know you're thinking Saturn too, like I am. The settlement has been subject to thorough excavation since the endeavors of Selin, Watzinger, and Garstang in late 19th century. Now, Selin, Watzinger, and Garstang, interesting names, especially Garstang, because he is one of the founders of the British School of Archaeology in Jerusalem, which was co-founded with, I believe, Sir Frederick George Kenyon and Sir Israel Gallants.
Didn't take us to get right back. And of course, we've already discussed Israel Galantz and the previous shows with Jacob and that, you know, Israel Galantz's nephew was Victor
Galantz.
Victor Galantz, who was the printer for the Fabian Society and for Aldous Huxley and all of those frauds that bleed right down into MK Ultra.
Oh yeah, I mean, this mass observation. Thomas Harrison has a few books underneath him.
Right.
It's just interesting. We're coming right back up in here, and flamenco, you know, he likes to talk about how in the 19th century, you know, this is kind of where everything kind of solidifies, and you're kind of seeing where history is kind of being, the standard is being set. And, you know, if we're going to try to find where the standard's being set, who was the empire at that time that had the most global control? Well, it's the British Empire. And we can see that, you know, these people, you know, associations are, I mean, you can go so deep with it. I mean, John Garstang, I'm just going to click on his name. Should I go on a share screen here so you can kind of see
sure.
on my brain database? So right now I have John Garstang called up.
Okay. All right, there we go.
So there's John Garstang. He's responsible for the British School of Archaeology in Jerusalem.
Your video card is working overtime there, just so you know. But it is showing, but it's struggling.
Okay. He was the president or the director of the Department of Antiquities, which is developed under the Mandatory Palestine. He was responsible for the Jericho Expedition. Now, the Jericho Expedition was actually, let's go back to John Garstang quick, because you can see he's associated with Sir Frederick George Kenyon. As you can see, he's a decorated man with letters.
Yeah, your video card is really working hard there.
Maybe I'll just close the brain and I'll just use my web version of it, or I'll close the Safari.
Well,
I'll close Safari. That one will probably be better to close.
Yeah, it's your video card. It's just showing what's showing on screen right now. It's just overworked. Just go quickly so we can get out of, you know, get rid of the share screen.
Well, I'll just get rid of it because I'm going to be going through this for a little bit, and it's just going to be a struggle.
All right.
So Sir Frederick George Kenyon, he is the father. He was the president of the British Academy for a time. What's interesting is he's associated with Arthur James Balfour, who is also president of the British Academy. He was responsible for the British Mandate in Palestine.
You're not suggesting that they did all this based on like fake history, are you? Am I giving it away too soon?
Well, what I'm saying is that there seems to be a cell of people who are interested in creating a state in a land based off of biblical history. And this biblical history goes back and is kind of tied to the chronology placed down by Joseph Scaliger, the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, the Roman Catholic Church is heavily involved in this, especially once the mandate is set in place.
Well, and then, obviously, Petavius and probably Scaliger as well were Jesuits. And then, Petavius was. And then, you know, so this would show an interest with the Catholic Church in all of this.
Yeah.
And then you have the Council of Trent, which Flamenco suggests was when they officialized the official Scaligerian chronology and then force that on to, you know, society.
Yeah. Basically, I mean, they're using this to kind of force everything on everybody. I mean, all right, so we're talking about biblical archaeology. And remember we talked about the Israel Stella with Sir William Flinders Petrie? And he was talking, and this is controversial, but he says that Israel was first mentioned on the Stella in Canaan or Canaan.
Right.
So, you know, that translation is by consensus. It's not a fact. It's not proven. Okay. So this is one of the foundation pieces. And this is from Sir William Flinders Petrie, who founded the British School of Archaeology in Egypt. And he's an Egyptologist who, interestingly enough, was the teacher of Margaret Murray. And he was also the teacher of Gerald Lancaster Harding. And Gerald Lancaster Harding was one of the people who worked with Father DeVoe to create the team for the Dead Sea Scrolls. Which, you know, it also helps solidify this idea that there's a historical basis of the Bible being in Palestine.
Right, right. And then Allegro And of course, I'm Allegro's publisher, and Allegro was one of the original eight on the Dead Sea Scrolls team. So he, Allegro, puts together his own private team, and he goes around and digs in the desert and tries to find all of this stuff that's laid out in the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Copper Scroll, and writes a book on it. You know what he found? Nothing. And I think Allegro was legit. And another reason why I think Allegro was legit and believed the historical veracity of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I was talking with his daughter about this the other day, but I think, you know, what happened was, after enough years of research on the Dead Sea Scrolls, he's seeing all of this Bacchanalia stuff, all of the Dionysian worship that's embedded in it, and he's like, wait a second, you know, the Bible is covered, these ancient documents, when we go through this, it's covered with this Bacchanalia drug sex worship stuff. And then he comes out with it, and they go apeshit attacking him, that, you know, he's completely lost his mind. But in chapter 7 of Fomenko's Chronology 1, he argues that the Catholic Church had to create the Dark Age to make it look like the Bacchanalia and the drug pagan worship throughout Europe was ancient history, and give the illusion, you know, and that the, you know, and to cover up when the Inquisitions really were. He argues that it was like in the 15th or 16th century when the Inquisitions happened. So they create this Dark Age to shove history back, so that it makes it appear, you know, from the Saturnalian Kronos chronology point of view, that this is all ancient history. And then they have the Council of Trent, they rewrite everything, they present this new view. And then Allegro's like, you know, looking at these Dead Sea Scrolls going, wait a second, who is one of the guys who led the attack on him? Was Father DeVoe from the Ecole Biblique. Right.
Yes.
And they get, you know, they get Allegro thrown off the team, you know, and Allegro, they're having a conniption fit, because Allegro, he's working with King Hussein of Jordan, and he's like best friends with King Hussein, and King Hussein's funding him. And then they're like, well, oh shit. And they have this little thing called the Six-Day War, and they take over all of King Hussein's stuff where the Dead Sea Scrolls are. So I think it's highly possible that John Allegro and King Hussein were inadvertently responsible for the Six-Day War, because they had to hush up what, you know, Allegro and King Hussein were finding and putting out there, you know? So it makes this whole other interesting story. And Allegro, you know, I mean, Father DeVoe of the Ecole Biblique, I used to have all the members of the Scrolls team in my head. I can't think of them right now.
Father
Millick, John Strugnell was Strugnell is who came in from Oxford replacing Allegro, and then of course he railed on Allegro some more, you know. But you know, if we can imagine that they manufactured the Dead Sea Scrolls and then planted them, and then Allegro does the search in the desert, publishes a book on it, doesn't find anything. And he's, you know, Allegro's the guy trying to bring all of the attention to the scrolls. And they're like, wait on, hold on a second. Allegro was the only source of the Dead Sea Scrolls that anybody had. And they were trying to hush him up the whole way up until 1993. And then you have Dr. Robert Eisenman at the University of Cal State Long Beach here in California, who then, working with the Huntington Library and Israeli sources, then circumnavigates the Dead Sea Scrolls team and has the Dead Sea Scrolls published. And Allegro is right there in the center of this. And Allegro is like, wait a second, it's all fertility drug worship. So when we look at this angle and why they needed to hush Allegro up in view of chronology and this possibility, it makes a whole lot more sense of why they attacked Allegro, you know. You know, we're already at the top of the hour, so go in and read these quotes, and we're already going overtime here, so
it's not our first time. But before I go to the scholar quote, while we're still on this, I have this speech by Father DeVoe called L'archéologie et les manuscrits de la mer morte, which is the manuscripts of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This was a speech given at the Schweik Lectures of the British Academy in 1959. So this is like in the heat of when Allegro was trying to get everybody to start publishing, because he's like, hey, I have all this stuff. Let's get going. Let's do the Copper Scrolls. I want to do the Copper Scrolls. So this was given at the British Academy. And Constance Schweik is the daughter of Leopold Schweik. And she created the Memorial Fund, and she's one of the primary funders of the British Academy. And when she created that Memorial Fund, one of the things that was part of it was that there should be lectures given about proving the biblical history. So, you know, we're looking at biblical archaeology, and we're looking at Palestine, we're looking at these groups, and they're associated, and they go back all the way even back to the 1870s, before Israel's even started, and you can see that they're laying the foundations for trying to create this state. And it's, you know, that's not, these aren't light words to say, but all the evidence just keeps kind of going, pointing back to Israel being a fabrication. Like a complete one.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, I those are words that shouldn't be said lightly.
Yeah. But, it appears that the evidence is really going in that direction. And so, you know, this is really important stuff that they're, I mean, you know, it's not like my channel's not already shadow banned. You know, how do you shadow ban a shadow banned channel?
I mean, yeah, you just started to get kind of meta there. So you said you wanted to go back to those quotes. Now there's, we're talking about trolls earlier, and about people who attack Skelliger and him using pen names and stuff like that. Well, there was this man. Let me just find the page. Okay, so there's a footnote all the way at the end. This is one of the final books of Skelliger's, and this actually precedes a really extensive notation on Skelliger's chronology by the editors. It is actually kind of interesting to read, but I don't know if you wanted to add the time to that. But this is David Perius on Skelliger's chronology. David Perius, professor of divinity at Heidelberg, having found something to censure in the chronological calculations of Skelliger, raised the resentment of our author, who could not bear contradiction, and who published this answer, in which he treated Perius with so much contempt that the latter, imputing this severe way of writing to the study of critical learning, then so much in fashion, told his son one day that the devil was undoubtedly the author of that kind of learning. So this is the description out of the book that was in Latin that I couldn't really read before this, but essentially, I mean, this is a professor of divinity who teaches critical thinking, who attacks Skelliger's chronology, and
calls it the work, the teaching of the devil.
Well, he says that rather than Skelliger approaching him like a man and going point by point and detailing how this man is wrong in his opinions and his review, he does say he attacks him. And because of these attacks, which are, how did he place that? That are imputing the severe way of writing to the study of critical learning so much in fashion. So it was a severe, it was the attack that was so severe. And he taught all of his students, this is bullshit artist 101. This is the making of the devil. So essentially the trolling, the propaganda, the attacks is the making of the devil, because he's not speaking the truth. He's deflecting the truth and attacking. So rather than being on the defensive, he goes in the offensive. And that's his strategy. Whenever he gets attacked, he attacks the person back, and he attacks them harder and louder and with his friends. And
basically a bunch of desk pounding and, you know, et cetera, screaming.
Yeah. Like, how dare you attack me? I'm a learned man.
It's like, right. You know, and people called him the most learned man in Europe at the time, when the guy is just a complete fraud. It's like, you know, people today think that Einstein is the smartest man of modern times, and the guy was a fraud, you know.
Oh, it's his first book. Okay. You're going to love this. Okay. So his writings, they are as follows. Number one, Conjectania in M. Terentium Veronian de Lingua Latina. This is in Paris in 1565. Skelliger wrote this work at 20 years of age. Gerald John Vossius, 1. observes that, that's just a footnote, observes that his conjectures are too bold, and he did not act sincerely in suppressing the ancient readings, which he met within the manuscripts of the author, or which he met in the manuscripts of the author, and adds that Peter Victoria said that Joseph Scaliger was born to corrupt, the ancients rather than to correct them. Let me say that again. Gerald John Vossius observes that his conjectures are too bold, and he did not act sincerely in suppressing the ancient readings, which he met with in the manuscripts of his author, and adds that Peter Victoria said that Joseph Scaliger was born to corrupt the ancients rather than to correct them. I mean, that's at 20 years of age.
You know,
right off his father's education.
Now,
too.
Just so the audience knows, this is nothing that we have found yet in any of Fomenko's work. This is stuff that Jacob has gone out and found on his own and pulled up that actually entirely substantiates what Fomenko found using mathematical algorithms and discovering phantom histories. You know, and focusing in on Scaliger, and now we're finding all of these contemporary sources that also concur with Fomenko. So, you know, now we're laying a foundation, and we haven't even given this information to Fomenko yet. And speaking of which, you and I still haven't found the time to, you know, put together the interview questions for Fomenko, and he has tentatively agreed to come on the show sometime soon. So, you know, we can begin to put all of this stuff together. We can send him these quotes, et cetera, so he has them for his own work. But
There's so much to add to it. And what's great about this, you mentioned that he comes from the statistical aspect of it. I'm approaching this from the literary textual analysis perspective.
Absolutely.
So, you know, there's different grades of scholarship that could be applied to this history and this learning. You know, and there's different skills and talents that can be applied. You know, we need people who are fluent in Latin and Greek, Russian. You know, if there's anybody out there that knows these languages and are fluent and are willing to help out, I mean, we'd greatly appreciate it because there's so much information out there. There's so many books that we just can't read. And I don't have the time to learn Latin at the moment. I work 12 hours of my day almost every single day are dedicated to work. So, you know, I stretch my life quite a bit doing what I'm doing already.
Understood. So is this a good place to wrap it up, Jacob?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's going to be a lot more information I could pull out of Scaliger, but I'd rather have that kind of neatly noted and put in place. And then if we ever have time, we can kind of go over it again, because I know there's going to be more topics to talk about when it comes to
this. Absolutely. Well, you know, thanks for coming back on. You want to give the audience your email address in case they want to contact you or send you a donation?
Yeah, you can email me at Jacob Duellman. That's JACOBDUELLMAN at gmail.com. Any kind of support would be greatly appreciated. I've put a lot of time and effort into collecting books and rare books to try to kind of understand what's going on with this history. So any support would be greatly appreciated.
And likewise for the show, if you like and appreciate what you hear, please support the show. We survive on donations. I just had to throw down a whole bunch more money yesterday on a new web server. I still haven't gotten the main server here taken care of. As you and I talked about last week, I got new hard drives into it. That was all I could raise on the donation front for that. So I still am going to have to replace that soon. But all the support and donations we could get, we should do a whole show just on like a fun drive front one day.
Well, you know, I actually have an idea for that. We've been talking about doing a Grand Tartary poll.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and we can just do that at any time. We don't have to do that on a planned Tuesday. So any free time, we can just do a live show. So we'll do that soon. And have fun just, you know, digging through the citations on Tartary and finding what we can.
It'd be a good fundraising drive when you think about it, too, but that's plenty we could talk about some other time.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Well, Jacob, thank you so much. Everyone in the audience, much appreciated. See you next week, and talk to you soon, everybody. Take care.